You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm very excited today because my guest is Wilfredo Noyedo. He is a Philippine novelist, and we have a history together, in a sense. His novel is called But for the Lovers. It was originally published in 1970. I met him in the early 70s when I was a student at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He was a visiting scholar and teacher of creative writing. His novel had just come out, and he was beginning what should have been a very bright literary career. The book had been published by the very esteemed literary editor Hal Sharlock at Dutton. And as it happened, the editor died. There were no further books published by Noyedo. This book itself, But for the Lovers, went out of print for many years. It was virtually unheard of. And then, to my great delight, the Donkey Archive Press announced that it was going to be publishing, in its revived classics series, the novel But for the Lovers. Well, I called them up and I said, well, you know, he was a teacher of mine, and I haven't heard of him for years. I haven't known whether he's even been alive. And is it possible that we might be able to talk together on the radio? Well, they told me, in fact, that he lives just outside Los Angeles, that it wouldn't be hard at all to make sure he comes to the studio in Los Angeles. And so this is a meeting after some 23, 24 years. I wondered if you can fill me in. How did the book come to the Dalkey Archive Press?
Well, Michael, it was, Robert Cooper, you know, the novelist, has been in touch with Dalkey. And so I think he referred the book to Dalkey Archive.
Coover is an American avant-garde writer whose book, A Night at the Movies, I believe Dalkey Archive has resurrected as well. They are, to my mind, the premier press in terms of avant-garde American literature, making sure it stays in print mm-hmm. and that it doesn't disappear from the culture. We have a culture that's not preserving it. How did Coover come to know of the book?
You mean But for the Lovers?
Yes.
Well, yeah. Well, if you don't mind, there's a brief genesis, you know, connected
yes.
with this. At the time I was, you know, in the writer's workshop, I was Andrew, who said Donoso. And the following year, I was under Robert Cooper. But then, you know, I had written the prologue for But for the Lovers. And also, I was writing a thriller with a South Africaner who had an agent connected with Paul Reynolds. Well, the agent, you know, read our thriller since I was writing all the violent parts and the other guy was writing the exposition, you know, the agent, John Hawkins, got very curious. Who's writing that section? He asks. So, you know, he finds out about me. Gives me a call from New York, you know. And then when he's in town in Iowa City, he looks me up. And then he says, you know, do you have stuff of your own? And, of course, I'd been writing, you know, these five chapters of But for the Lovers. And I said, you know, later, you know, I'm going to show you the chapters. So when I was with Robert Cooper the next year in the workshop, I gave him the five chapters, which he, in turn, you know, showed to John Hawkins. And, you know, with the reading of five chapters, I think Hal Charlotte became very interested, the editor. And that was how it started, you know.
It's a novel of the Philippines during the Second World War. And as Coover mentions in his introduction, it very much partakes in the more frenzied of the techniques of magical realism, not so much the miracles as the swarm of image and the multiple voices. Mm-hmm. There's a writer figure who's mentioned in the epilogue to the book. His name is Placido Rey, and he's described as attempting to exercise his current fixation and plunging furiously into his journal. Quote, on ruled yellow tablet paper with a jug of tea and no tobacco, he wrote his blood pressure high and low with all the figures of speech at his command, carving curlicues out of a vernacular that defied his salutations, his emendations, his immolations, recanting, reviling, demythologizing a legato of facts, reconstructing with vicarious military acumen every facet that had engendered and ennobled Intramuros. Is that you?
No, as a matter of fact, Placido Rey is just as, you know, helpless as all the others who define this persona. You know, he has no way of knowing her. But, you know, everyone is so fascinated, so obsessed with Alma, because she's a presence and yet she's an absence at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Let me take you back to the prologue. I mean, you know, the prologue, to my way of thinking, is sort of like in the cinema, you know. It is in black and white. So, in print, it is italicized, italics mine. But when I say italics mine, I say italics mine with a D. The whole thing is a minefield.
Uh-huh.
It's swarming with, you know, images, metaphors, what have you. So you start with the myth of the Sleeping Beauty, because that's the central theme. You know, she never wakes up. If you will notice at the end of the book, the very last sentence, her name is enclosed in parentheses.
Yes.
She still has to be born.
It's a very interesting thing, because this book, But for the Lovers, centers around characters of different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
They're all there in Manila. There are the Japanese invaders, the American so-called defenders. There are the Spanish of a previous occupation. There are the Filipinos and the many different languages of imposed cultures.
Yes.
Enter the book as well. At the center of the book is this dreamer, a woman who we come to know is named Maria Alma.
Mm-hmm.
And she is never, by and large, awake, or when awake, she's very much being prepared.
Or controlled.
Controlled by the men around her to be certain things.
Yes.
May I ask you what she represents?
The country. I mean, you know, you see, long before there was a third world, we were already a third world. But, you know, it was a process of, you know, definition, defining oneself, defining one's, you know, culture, one's strengths, everything, you know. When the Spaniards came, you know, they sort of molded us into a religious, you know, bastard. But they found that they couldn't control us, you know, after about almost 400 years. And then the Americans came, and they had, a subtler way of doing it. Commercially, the Spaniards tried to do it with the church, spiritually, or through the Inquisition, but nothing happened. You know, this woman, this country stayed the same. My problem now is, you know, in fact, it was meant to be a trilogy. I wrote the second book, and it got lost. Now I am in the third book.
The second book got lost?
Right, yeah. It was, as a matter of fact, you know, this is very funny because the whole thing was, you know, written out. I was going to send it to a publisher. I don't even have notes for it.
Well, under what conditions was it lost?
Moving, I think. We were moving.
My God, this is... this does seem to me to be a very odd story, because I know as well that at the time of her death, Jacqueline Onassis, who was at that time an editor at Doubleday,
right,
had been very interested in your work as well.
That's true.
And that the House finally decided, despite her enthusiasm, mm-hmm, not to publish your book. You seem to be in the tradition of the writer. I didn't know there was also a lost manuscript.
Yes.
How many books are there that remain of Noyedo unpublished now?
Well, right now I have, you know, three rough ones, you know. I have two finished ones. I'm doing minor revisions on a book called Sangria Tomorrow, which is actually, you know, the third. It's the third part of the trilogy. In this one, you know, it's not as, you know, as probably confusing as the first novel, you know, because I had learned quite a lot after the first novel. You know, I had been into movies, I'd written screenplays, and I was after clarity. I was after, you know, linearity, because you couldn't possibly call, you know, Bad for the Lovers a very linear novel.
No, in fact, the book it reminds me most of is also not linear, and in some of the same ways. It reminds me a lot of V.
Oh, yeah.
Because that book by Thomas Pynchon centers around, again, the search for a mysterious, undefinable woman.
An abstraction, yeah.
Yes, an abstraction, who appears, at least in that novel, in the form of various avatars who might potentially, mm-hmm, be V. Here, Alma, which means soul, yes,
yeah,
is one person, but it seems as if she will not stir to life. It's almost as if the book is a big Sleeping Beauty legend, an attempt to wake her, or something else as well. One of the central heroes in the book is a cavalier vaudevillian, mm, named Hidalgo, and she is his Dulcinea, and he is a version of Quixote, and he very much wants her to be what he wants her to be.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Michael, because, you know, another way of looking at it is that, you know, it is a kind of a reversal of Don Quixote. Only here in this Quixote, you know, take-off, we have a Sancho Panza who is very active. We have Mulabe Amoran, who is the Sancho Panza of the piece. But the thing is, he's very active. He wants to resurrect Alma. He's fighting this Spaniard all the way, you know. And, well, he's about to win the fight. And then, you know, the Holocaust comes and everything, you know. Hidalgo wants, it's kind of a double death wish between Hidalgo and Alma. And, you know, if Mulabe had allowed this to happen, you know, they would have killed each other or allowed each other to die or just absorb each other.
Now, one of the crucial disturbances in this book, which is, of course, as you say, a mind field and full of death, it's also, in certain ways, a torture chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And the most disturbing sections of the novel, to me at least, were sections describing, in a hallucinatory, but one suspects not all that surreal fashion, political torture. I wondered, because this is a realm in the many Holocausts for which writers bear responsibility, mm-hmm, to find language, this is a realm that very rarely finds its language. Has that interest in talking about the torture of a political tyranny maintained itself in your subsequent novels?
Well, as a matter of fact, I have in my latest novel, it's called If His Excellency Calls, Tell Him We're Out. Anyway, yeah, it's about, you know, that regime, and I do take up, you know, the fact of torture, incarceration, you know, political, you know, exile, all that. In fact, I have another play, a long play, which, amazingly enough, is like, you know, Asturias' play, you know, El Señor Presidente, which also got lost. That's the very title of it, El Señor Presidente. And then, you know, I had not heard about the Asturias play, novel, and I was told, well, that sounds like Asturias.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, I think of the literature of South America and the Pacific Islands as having invented a figure that does not exist otherwise, I think, in world literature, the figure of the dictator.
Mm-hmm.
It's there in Marquez's El Otoño del Patriarca and his later work as well. It's there in, as you mentioned, Asturias's novel. But the figure of the counterfigure, I think, Nabokov virtually named him. The tyrant is the person who opposes the imagination and replaces mm-hmm. the imagination. He seems in many ways a counter-novelist. He can do, by a stroke of imagination, cruelty, and power, what a novelist would only dare to do with a pen.
Yes.
I wondered if you could speak a bit about political tyranny in fiction.
Well, from what I've read and from what I've, experienced back home, not that we've had it recently, but it's always there. I mean, during the 40s, I was just a kid running around the streets, but I'd seen, bits and pieces. And I talked to people. In fact, right after the war, I had a best friend who was in the army. And he talked about, torture as a way of life. I mean, something that has to be planned, orchestrated, and there's no inhumanity about it. The way he talks.
What do you mean when you say there's no inhumanity about it?
I mean, this man is not cruel. I mean, it's like a homework, it's like homework.
Homework, God.
If you remember something like, Dr. Strangelove, the general played by, George C. Scott, who discusses, who talks about mortality rates, death rates, just like that. I mean, they're like that, I mean, the military mind, with the help of some technocrats, the fusion of these two, of course, produces a third mentality, which is, just way out.
Has this book been published in the Philippines?
But for the Lovers?
Yes.
No. The first part, the prologue was published as a short story, as I said. But other than that, it hasn't been published.
What would could you anticipate the response to it?
In fact, if I have to, quote some of my reviews, on the book, it became sort of a cult following, it wasn't the popular, book that I, knew it wasn't.
It was not a surprise.
Right, it was not a surprise. And in fact, afterwards, after Bad for the Lovers, I think they sort of like the other books better. At least the published parts of what I had written, because I would enter, literary contests back home for the novel. That's an annual thing. And I would win, almost every year. The major prize, something like, 25,000 pesos. And the latest one, the title is 21 de Agosto, and which has something to do with the death, the killing of Senator Aquino. If you are familiar with that.
Yes.
And but then I departed from, just the factual story. I pulled it back into the future. Or I was just using the title and some of the characters, but it was very futuristic. And actually I have, Arabs all over the Philippines. There's the petro peso and no pork and all that. So, but it won in the contest.
I'm speaking to Wilfredo Noyedo, the author of But for the Lovers, published by Dolke Archive Press, one of the premier protectors of the literary avant-garde in the United States. I want to get a sense of time here. You were born in the Philippines,
yes.
In Manila,
mm-hmm.
And you came and were a student at the Iowa Writers' Workshops.
In 1966.
Now, when I met you, you were teaching contemporary American literature.
That was for the summer, yeah.
Yes, Barthelme, Coover, Pynchon,
mm-hmm.
others. Now, when you had come to America, had you known that literature or had it suddenly erupted upon you?
What I was writing then?
Yes.
I had always been writing like that, you know. I mean, as a matter of fact, back home, judges of this literary contest would say, you know, Mr. Noliero, you know, it can be very confusing and, you know, powerful language and stuff like that. But, you know, well, they had rather a hard time with me, although I kept winning.
What were your influences back home?
Oh, okay. When I was in college, of course, everybody was reading Hemingway and Faulkner and, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald. But my big thing then was Joyce. And then we had my favorite Filipino writer is Nick Joaquin, who writes both in Spanish and English. He is a very powerful writer. And I'm only sorry to say that, you know, he's not better known here in the United States because he is really something. He was my first major influence.
Is his work accessible here?
Well, I can get copies of his books, but they're not really sold, you know, unless you order for them back home.
Because it's very interesting, in fact, in the 24 years since I first met you, it's not as if there has been in America a sense of what Filipino literature is like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a tradition we're virtually in ignorance of.
There are some very good Filipino writers here, N.B.M. Gonzalez and Bienvenido Santos. They're well ahead of me. But they are the senior, or I would say the elder statesmen of Philippine letters.
Have you seen the work of Jessica Hagedorn at all?
No.
She's an interesting writer. She's much more influenced by the United States and life in New York. She was born here,
mm-hmm.
I believe, but it's very much a search for her background, where she comes from, and a sense of the kind of jumbled rhythms of Tagalog, attempting to replicate those in English. This book, too, But for the Lovers, has a lot of linguistic, intercultural play. Do you feel that you have to invent the sentence as a writer who works with a sense of three or four languages?
I think that when I was writing But for the Lovers, I had this very strong feeling that kind of style demanded it. That kind of book almost dictated it. Because I'm not always like that in all my books. Yeah, several levels, but not, you know, not the whole maelstrom of words, because I can really simplify it, you know. I mean, every which way.
I wanted to end by asking you about something that I would imagine it must be very hard to talk about. You are now, I believe, 61 years old.
Yes.
And there is one published novel that was published in 1970,
mm-hmm.
resurrected in 1994. What has kept you writing?
Back home, of course, I was mainly a journalist. I was editing magazines and newspapers for the groceries, for the grunts. But I had, of course, a double life. I was writing my own stuff. And, of course, as I said, I was winning prizes. But I was so frustrated because, you know, they were never published.
Yes.
So my wife, you know, tells me that, well, you should do something about your serious work. So we had started sending my work, you know, abroad back here. And Robert Cooper was still in touch with me then, you know, when I was in the Philippines. And he recommended me to some people. And then I got a letter from, the late Mrs. Onassis. And that was a very long correspondence, by the way. I mean, it took us several months. And she liked what she read. She liked Sangria. And, you know, I was really, really disappointed when finally it came down to this, that she had turned over the typescript to her editors, and the judgment was that it was not the right book for them. But, you know, it was almost a year. So I was waiting for that, waiting for something to happen. And in the meantime, I was also writing other things. I was writing plays, you know, and other novels.
But you have been, consequently, a writer virtually all your life without an audience.
Mm-hmm.
How does one continue? I mean, does one continue?
Look, I had an audience back home. Very, very picky, you know, people, you know, who don't really usually read anything, you know. Probably, you know, it's because of those people, you know, that, you know, I didn't lose, you know, heart. When it comes to the situation here, because I know I'm going to break through. I have that faith, that mass faith in my stuff. And besides, I can't stop, you know.
I've been speaking to Wilfredo Noyedo, the author of But for the Lovers, an old teacher of mine from the State University of New York at Buffalo, where he was visiting as a summertime scholar, the author of many unpublished books, and one, But for the Lovers, which has been revived by the Dalkey Archive Press, hopefully to reignite his literary career in the United States. Thank you for joining me, Willie.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Wow.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.